Welcome to a Migration Policy Institute podcast series on critical immigration, health, and educational policies affecting young children of immigrants. Introducing each session is Michael Fix, Senior Vice President and Director of Studies and Co-Director of the National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy. And now here's Michael.
We'll take up the issue of education. We'll have paper presentations by Rob Krosno, the University of Texas, and Linda Espinosa from the University of Missouri, two of the nation's absolutely leading experts on immigrant education and the education of immigrant children, and almost equally importantly, two of the most lucid writers on the topic. My colleague Margie McHugh will moderate that session. Margie's the co-director of the National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy, and in her earlier life, she was the founder and executive director of the New York Immigration Coalition.
So I am Margie McHugh. I'm the co-director of NPI's National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy, and it is my pleasure to move us into the second panel session of the day, which has to do with early learning and school readiness. As many of you know, there's been an explosion in knowledge over the past decade that clearly establishes the importance of the birth to 5 years in setting a child on track for education and life success. The knowledge that gaps in healthy development and school readiness skills begin so early in a child's life has brought new energy and urgency to efforts at the federal level and in many states to invest early before achievement gaps have had a chance to open up and multiply. At the same time, though, that our 0-5 programs and systems are undergoing a pretty historic rethinking and rebuilding, states and localities are also coming to terms with the enormous demographic change that's been taking place in the U.S. and in their states and cities in recent decades. The process of owning this demographic change, understanding and incorporating its implications in early childhood system building efforts is, to say the least, unfolding in a very uneven manner across the country. So we are very, very lucky to have two leading researchers with us today who will speak to us about some of the challenges and opportunities that we're seeing around the country and at the federal level in these issues of early learning and school readiness. First, Rob Krosno will present a paper that provides an understanding of key factors influencing school readiness and early school success for children of immigrants. And then Linda Espinosa will focus on the qualities of early learning programs that promote school readiness and success for dual language learners. Dr. Krosno, I was going to just say he was a professor in the sociology and psychology departments at UT Austin, but you all can probably see that it is a much more delicious name for his position, the Elsie and Stanley E. Skinny Adams, Senior Centennial Professor in Liberal Arts. I hope nobody from your school is looking at this and thinking that we're not. I just wonder what it must be like to be the Skinny Adams professor and have everybody do a double take, wondering what that means. So a good deal of Rob's work has been focusing on the health, psychosocial development, and education trajectories of children from immigrant families. So we're just really looking forward to the sort of synthesis and perspective that that informs his work and the presentation that he's going to be able to provide. And then we'll have the privilege of hearing from Dr. Linda Espinosa, who's currently co-principal investigator for the Center for Early Care and Education Research that's focused specifically on dual language learners at the Child Development Institute at UNC North Carolina, UNC Chapel Hill. Somehow she is also at the same time the lead consultant at the other end of the country for the California Department of Education, consulting on best practices for young dual language, their young dual language learners project, which, doing that work in California and sort of blazing a path there is so important given the how prominently that state figures in these issues. So it is fair to say that she's the go-to person in the country for discussions of effective curriculum and assessment practices for young children from low-income families who are dual language learners, so we're really delighted that we sort of nabbed her to both write this paper and to be here with us today. So we're really, really excited about this panel, and we'll get going with Rob's presentation. His PowerPoint is actually in the sort of black folders that you have, so you'll be able to follow along. If you're ready, Rob, we're ready.
I do have a lot of good bull about being the skinny professor, but I can think of at least five people in this room who've heard that bull before, and I don't like repeating myself. So if you want to hear it, just come ask me at the break, and I'll tell you about it. It also struck me that the majority of the speakers so far have roots in Texas, and so I think we're part of this continuing onslaught of Texans on Washington, D.C., so... Don't hold that against us, though. So I was a member of the inaugural cohort of the Young Scholars Program at the Foundation for Child Development, and the focus of my project those many, many years ago was on the school readiness of children from immigrant families, and that's what I'm going to be talking about today. So there's a really interesting story there, and it gets at this debate between immigrant paradox and immigrant risk, but with a twist. So the paradox is that given what we know about the predictors of school performance in the United States and given what we know about the socioeconomic characteristics of the immigrant population in the United States, the children of immigrants should be faring quite poorly in American schools, but that's not exactly true. They're doing a lot better than you would think that they are. The paradox lost is that the early childhood years seem to constitute an exception to that general trend of immigrant paradox. And the paradox we found is that by studying that exceptional period, we may be able to point our way to things that can be done to more fully support the immigrant paradox or more fully realize the immigrant paradox across the school career. So I think that these are data from the National Educational Longitudinal Study, which get at the basic idea of the immigrant paradox. These are math and science test scores across different grades of high school. And you see that, in general, the children of immigrants outperform the children of native-born parents, especially when you control for the more disadvantaged socioeconomic circumstances of the former. Now, there is a lot of variation in this general pattern by race and ethnicity and national origin. And for example, Asian immigrants, this pattern is much more pronounced for Asian immigrants than for other groups. It's often attributed to things like parental support, community cohesion, psychological well-being, an adult versus peer orientation. But one important point is that as you move down from adolescence into earlier ages, you see that the picture gets murkier, right? The evidence of an immigrant paradox is less consistent in early childhood or childhood years, and it often even points to something more akin to immigrant risk than immigrant paradox. So to illustrate that, these are data from the Early Childhood Longitudinal Study Birth Cohort, or ECLSB, and they represent combined math and reading test scores the year before and the year after school entry. And there's inconsistency here. So you see a consistent immigrant paradox for black kids. You see a consistent immigrant risk for Latino kids. You see a slight emergence of an immigrant paradox for Asian kids and a slight emergence of immigrant risk for white kids. So there's a lot going on here, and I would say that the conclusion is that the early childhood years, the years around school entry, are one point where we might be concerned and where we might focus our attention. So then the question is, well, why is this happening? And I think that one huge difference between the elementary school patterns, the early patterns, and the secondary school patterns is undoubtedly about sampling bias. You know, these are school-based studies. We know that older immigrants are less likely to enter the American educational system in the first place, and even when they do, they're more likely to drop out. So that means that the older samples are undoubtedly more selective than the younger samples. And you cannot discount that. And that is something that I try and hit home every time I talk about this issue. But I do think that there is something else going on that's more like adaptation. You know, the longer that the kids are here, the more they get used to the system and the better off that they do. So I would argue that it's important to identify the factors that weaken or eliminate or even reverse the immigrant paradox during these early childhood years, during the school transition period, and focus on them and try and figure out what's going on and what we can do about them to more fully support the immigrant population. So you know, there's many of these factors that I could talk about, so I chose three because I don't have a lot of time. And I picked them because they are all major points of discussion in the research literature. They're all explicitly connected to extant policy interventions and strategies. And perhaps most importantly, they're all things that I study and know a lot about. So the first one is early education programs, which Linda's going to talk a lot more about today. And, you know, more and more we are seeing a view of early intervention as one of the best remedies for many different kinds of inequalities in education, including those related to immigration. And the conceptual model is that early exposure to structured learning and cognitive stimulation can help children from vulnerable groups make up some of the gaps in school readiness that play such an outsized role in long-term disparities in educational attainment. But the issue is that, as Linda is going to talk about, that children from immigrant families are less likely to be enrolled in these programs before the start of school. And there's a variety of reasons for that that are practical in nature, as well as having to do with the perceptions of child care and preschool more generally. So it would seem that immigration is inversely correlated with enrollment in early education programs, which is positively associated with school readiness. And that would mean that you would take the you would try and target that first link in the sequence as a way of affecting change over time. Now, one way to do this is certainly within the purview of the federal early education programs, which are all about expanding access, as well as the initiatives, the public initiatives that we see in many states. For example, in Oklahoma, which is the Oklahoma initiative that Deborah Phillips is closely associated with. In my own home state of Texas, I have it's an interesting thing. Well, it's interesting about a lot of these programs across many different states and on the federal level. They tend to focus or target low-income populations. Well, because immigrants are overrepresented in low-income populations, these programs indirectly or unofficially target immigrant populations. And that's certainly true in a state like Texas. So over the last couple of years, I've spent a lot of time and money from the Foundation for Child Development looking at the transitions between public pre-K programs and elementary schools of immigrant children. And the public program in Texas has two main criteria, low income and English language learners. So I will let you guess who is in these schools when you go into them. It is not very hard to figure out. And one thing that's always struck me is that seeing how the district does outreach efforts to immigrant-heavy communities. The information from those outreach efforts then gets disseminated, and from the schools then gets disseminated, gets exchanged through the networks in these communities. So what that means is that if you have immigrant communities with really interconnected networks of families, over some point of time, going to these preschools just becomes normative, and the outreach efforts aren't really needed anymore, right? So it's just about getting the ball rolling and then letting the community take over after that. So another issue has to do with health. And I'm writing a book right now, and the general premise of which is that, you know, health and education are longstanding targets of research and policy, but they're often not connected to each other. And I think it's really important to connect them, especially with immigrants. So the working model here is that, you know, it's hard to do well in school when you don't feel well. Health problems keep kids out of learning environments, and even when they're in learning environments, it reduces their ability to engage in those learning environments. And, you know, as Jenny talked about, even though immigrant children enjoy a mental health advantage, the physical health picture is not quite as clear, especially with early childhood. You know, there is evidence that young children of immigrants are more likely to suffer from many illnesses and health problems than their native-born peers or their peers from native-born families. This is in stark contrast to infancy and adolescence, and even adulthood for that matter. So what that means, or what I think is going on here, is that the illnesses and health problems that kids tend to have in early childhood are less related to things like social support and health behavior, and they are more related to things like environmental exposure to pathogens and access to health care. So immigration status might be inversely associated with physical health during this period, which is then directly associated with school readiness. So we need to think about health promotion as an educational strategy. Now, you know, as Leighton talked about today, the whole idea of immigrant access to health and human services is very tricky. There are many immigrants, including many legal permanent residents, who do not have access to our major health and human services programs. Now, the Affordable Care Act is going to improve that situation, but it's not going to eliminate that situation at all. There are longstanding barriers that we really have to think about, including such things as awareness of programs, confusion over program enrollment, and fears about entering the system, especially in mixed-status families. Now, in the project that that I was a part of with AJ and Hero that AJ alluded to, and I think Hero is going to be talking about later, what we found was that community-based organizations play a really important role in reducing some of these barriers, community-based organizations that have strong ties to immigrant communities. More specifically to children, formal partnerships between school districts and healthcare districts can really make a lot of progress along these issues, too. So the third thing these are health statistics, sorry. These are reports of parent reports of poor health among children at various ages of early childhood. And you can see there's a very consistent pattern where immigrant parents are much more likely to say that their kids are in poor health. It's funny because when you actually ask them about specific health problems like asthma, this trend is reversed. And so some people say, well, what do the health assessments actually mean, these global health assessments? Well, global health assessments are about the best validated and most powerful predictor of long-term disparities in health problems and mortality that you can find. So I would actually think that the questions about more specific health problems are more in line with what Leighton and Jenny were talking about today, having to do with diagnoses and healthcare access. Okay, so the last thing is family-school partnerships. And, you know, a big component of that is parental involvement in education, which has long been a huge component of almost all theoretical models of educational inequality. And it's always a tricky thing to talk about parenting in relation to inequality because you start sliding towards this deficit language. And it also comes across, even if it's not intended, as blaming the victim. So having said that, I still think that this is an important discussion to engage with, especially for immigrant populations, not the least of which is because parental involvement is still such a huge component of educational policies and school reforms in the United States. In my mind, it's the go-to thing that schools and districts are always talking about, even if nobody knows what they're doing. So the model here is that when parents construct home learning environments, when they engage with school personnel, they're supporting the learning of their children, especially children from vulnerable groups, by demonstrating the value of education, by being empowered in schools, by learning more about what's going on in school. But there is evidence that immigrant parents are less likely to engage in some of these parental involvement behaviors. These are counts of different parental involvement behaviors that are school-based, dealing with interacting with school personnel versus home-based. And what you see is that the disparities are mostly confined to the school-based interactions, and they're much stronger for Latino parents, immigrant parents, than anybody else. Okay, well, there's a lot going on here, too. Language is huge. Poverty is huge. We also know that even independent of poverty, the educational level of the parents really matters. This is a human capital issue, and it's really closely related to two-generation interventions. There's also something to be said for the fact that many immigrant parents, even well-educated immigrant parents, don't fully grasp how important what an emphasis there is on parental involvement in American schools. American schools are different than school systems in many other countries. So, you know, what do you do about this? What do you do about that part of the sequence? And, I think that there are strategies out there that we can learn from. There have been success in some school districts by being flexible about their parental involvement activities to reflect the less scheduled of immigrant parents, especially immigrant parents who are in the low-wage labor market, who are migrant workers and that sort of thing. We know that there are community-based organizations and national advocacy organizations like National Council of La Raza that have had success creating programs targeting Latino immigrant parents of young children to demystify the American educational system for them. And in my own research in Texas, I saw the extreme power of parent support specialists in schools that are usually supported by Title I funds, that are dual language, that represent teachers but serve as advocate for parents. That bridge is a really important thing, as we talked about with healthcare reform, too. So in closing, you know, immigrant kids are doing better than you would expect in American schools overall, and this is a real testament to the immigrant narrative in the United States. However, I've argued here and in the past many times that you can't read this trend too simplistically, right? Because if you do, it's quite misleading. And I'm especially afraid, speaking to non-academic audiences when I do this, of giving the impression that there is no risk to be addressed here. Because there is risk to be addressed, and it's something that we can't ignore. School readiness is one kind of point at which that would be the case. Of course, the best way to support these risks or any other ones that we've talked about today is by more fully supporting and strengthening the position of immigrant parents in the United States and American society, which is something that would be best targeted through comprehensive immigration reform. In the absence of that, and if that doesn't happen, or if it's comprehensive with a lowercase c instead of a uppercase c, I would say we have great power in targeting the more proximate mechanisms of these disparities that play out in the everyday ecologies of children's lives. And I think that's what a lot of people in this room are thinking, and it's certainly a big theme of the Young Scholars Program at the Foundation. So thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, great. So now we'll turn the floor over to Dr. Linda Espinosa. Welcome, Linda.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me. It's a great turnout. This is a first for me. I'm actually speaking without PowerPoints, and I think I'm the only one in the group today. And if you know me, you'll be saying, thank God. It'll be the first time she's ever finished her PowerPoints. So what I'm going to do is describe some of the most salient points in my paper, which is a little bit long, maybe a little bit too detailed. But what I want to do is talk about the early educational policy for dual language learners. What are the policies and practices that promote school readiness? Okay, and I'm not going to go into some of the background information because you've heard that already this morning. You're going to hear more this afternoon. What I want to concentrate on are five aspects of early educational programming that seem to have salient and unique influences on the school readiness of dual language learners. So the first one is attendance and participation rates. The second one is general features of high quality early childhood education. The third one is language of instruction, which is a huge issue that's debated in this country. The fourth one is specific classroom strategies for dual language learners. What do we know about that? Getting beyond just general global recommendations, but what are some of the procedural guidelines that actual teachers and program people need to know about? And then finally, teacher qualifications and family and parent engagement practices. So, first of all, attendance participation rates. Where are young dual language learners at 9 months? At 24 months, at 52 months? Who is caring for them, and what is the quality of their care? And how does this care relate to their school readiness outcomes? As it turns out, and I think it was Jennifer who said this morning, there is no single story. There are, in fact, some complex interactions between multiple variables. So, for instance, if you just look at children of immigrants, the profile looks a little bit different than if you look at children of immigrants who are dual language learners. And if you look at dual language learners as a group, including those that are children of immigrants and those that are not children of immigrants, the pattern looks a little bit different again. So what we did as part of our CSER DLL, part of our research syntheses and activities there, we did a secondary analysis of the early childhood longitudinal study birth cohort. And these were children that were born in 2001. So I'd have to say, I mean, over the last 15 years or so, I've done a lot of work with the Eccles K. Those children started kindergarten in 1998. A lot has changed since then. A lot has changed in terms of the early childhood landscape, what's available, what are the perceptions of the country, and just the conditions of being an immigrant in this country. I think the Eccles B data are more current and more comprehensive around the birth to five issues that we're particularly interested in. We also get more information about language usage in the home, although not enough. You know, so we're moving forward in gaining a deeper and better understanding of what are the characteristics, what are the conditions of young children who are growing up in a home where English is not necessarily the primary language. You know, let me just say also, listening to this morning, I think, and listening to the health presentations, I think we truly are in a second generation of research stage. First generation had some broad global things. Children of immigrants don't attend child care as much as children of native-born families, citizens. In fact, that's not exactly true for all immigrant groups. You know, so again, like Jennifer, it's a more nuanced, and it's based upon country of origin and the age of the child. So if you look across the whole group that, of children who are growing up in immigrant families at 9 months, yes, they tend to not attend out-of-home non-parental care as frequently as children of native-born families. However, if you look at that profile at 24 months and 52 months, 52 months being the critical because that's the year before kindergarten, those disparities tend to kind of disappear. And once you control for SES and country of origin, they really do disappear. So it's not always clear what's operating here to give us a general and a more nuanced picture that might vary community by community. I'll just give you a little highlight of some of the things that we found. For instance, children who were of Indian descent were least likely to attend childcare across all age groups for some reason. DLLs in general tend to use relative care more than English-only families, and DL mothers with more education are more likely to use relative care than child care centers at all ages. But dual language families at 24 and 52 months, again, that's a fairly small percentage of the whole because at that point people are starting to transition their children into more group-based, center-based care. But there were a few differences in attendance patterns once we controlled for SES and country of origin. But like I said, in general, during those first 2 years, you get a higher attendance and participation rate in relative care, not so much, and this is really interesting, in home-based care, licensed home-based care, not so much for children of immigrants and not so much for children of dual language learners. So to some extent, some of those traditional conceptions we have about who participates, we have to start looking at what are some of the more detailed, nuanced data behind that might be different. For instance, like if you're in Minnesota and in Minneapolis, you have an immigrant group from Somalia and a Hmong group, and they are very different. Their child care attendance and participation patterns look very different than recent Mexican immigrants in Southern California, for instance. So these things vary by country of origin and by, by what are the conditions in the local communities that are receiving the families. Second aspect, general features of high quality in early childhood. And what I'm talking about are the features that are generally measured in, for instance, like the ECHR, the Early Childhood Environmental Rating Scale, or the CLASS system. These are measures of classroom quality. And all of those features of high quality in general early childhood, which we've known about for 10, 15 years, are important for dual language learners as well. So the things that we know that relate to and predict reading achievement in third grade, math achievement in third and fourth grade and whatnot, all of those variables in general early childhood also predict better scores at third and fourth grade for dual language learners. But the issue for us is it doesn't have the same effectiveness. So the effect sizes are smaller. And in early childhood, we're kind of finding the same thing that they found in the K-12 literature on the language minority, the National Report on Teaching Reading to Language Minority Students and Adolescents. Kind of the same thing. Basic good early childhood education, which includes things like a focus on oral language, which doesn't happen as often as we would like, and relationships, thank you, Deborah, and the work of Neurosity Neighborhoods, but the focus on relationships and explicit teaching of some schools, of some skills, particularly in the literacy area. All of those things are significant and important for dual language learners. But where we're coming to in the field is that within the context of high quality, there also have to be some special accommodations or adaptations for dual language learners. They're not sufficient in and of themselves to achieve the same level of school readiness as they lead to for monolingual English speaking students. And I hope I was clear about that particular point. Okay. Good. So the third thing is language of instruction. And this is the thing that I think in my work around the country, this is the thing that I find tends to be very divisive and almost religious. But it's a deeply felt issue, I guess. What language should children be speaking? What language should teachers be teaching in? From my own work over, I won't say how many years, but it's a long time, and in California and across the country kind of thing. But one of the things that I have found when you talk about language of instruction or what the science tells us is that people get blinded by their attitudes and their perceptions about the challenge of learning a second language. So that people have deeply felt beliefs, really, about what it means and what we should be doing in this country around acquiring English and or very young children, say a three-year-old from a very low-income home who needs to acquire English and what that might mean cognitively for the child. So I find that in this country, in general, in our early childhood field, that when children come into the programs and they are typically assessed in their English proficiency, if they're assessed, and they're typically assessed on skills. I mean, I've looked at many of the states' kindergarten entry assessments and state standards. Typically, the way they are assessed is in English. Can you come here? Can you sit down, et cetera? And the child might stare and look and doesn't know. So the child is seen as not having certain skills rather than embracing and accommodating the skills and the language capacity the child does possess and can't display in that particular environment. So I think, and this is a policy issue that I think can be addressed through some very simple messaging, but I think the response to a child who knows a language, and let's say maybe is very capable in a language other than English, but the group setting has no way of knowing that, the response to that child can shift in this country to this child possesses a potential asset and is potentially gifted, because in fact that is the literature on kids who have two languages. They do have many advantages cognitively, linguistically, self or executive function. They do have many advantages, but the perception of on the receiving end is frequently what they don't have to be able to fit into my English-only instruction. And I think we can change that. I really do, because we change attitudes and beliefs around smoking. with consistent and powerful public messaging, I think we really can help to see these children in the ways that they really are, which is potentially gifted and advantaged. When we did on the Eccles K, and this was several years ago, we disaggregated by language and SES status, and what we found was that children who had a second language at kindergarten entry, so they were non-English proficient at kindergarten entry, and they had a second language. Once you looked at SES and you looked at the upper quintiles of SES, those children actually exceeded monolingual English speaking, their monolingual English speaking peers at every testing period, and that was through fifth grade. I mean, which is quite extraordinary because these are our dual language learners, and they demonstrated capacities and excellence in a way that we wouldn't necessarily expect or look for from children who come from, say, recent immigrant Mexican families that come from very low income areas. But that's the potential. Okay. So I see our challenge in early childhood is to promote. There is no question in my mind, and I hope not in your minds, that learning a second language during the early childhood years is possible and children benefit from that. So children who have a language other than English when they come into the early childhood settings benefit and, in fact, need consistent, systematic, intentional exposure to English. There is no reason why we can't have a system that addresses that issue. Actually, and we have some good longitudinal data now that does say that children, the higher their English scores are at kindergarten entry, the better prognosis that is for third grade reading. But, I mean, there are huge caveats on this, but that doesn't mean at the expense of attention to the ongoing maintenance of the home language. So our challenge is to promote English language development. Unquestionably, it can and should be happening during the preschool years, while also supporting continued development of home language. So what are the specific classroom strategies? And I think that's where we need to go, maybe in a practical implementation arena, is some specific guidelines around, if you're a monolingual teacher, you believe in these principles, and that's already two steps down the road. You believe in the advantages of promoting both languages. But in your community, a dual language approach, which is ideal, is not possible. Either you don't have the capacity in your staffing and your adults, or you don't have a community context that supports it, or you have one infant toddler program I was in had 17 languages. Okay, you can't do instruction in 17 languages, and no teacher can be expected to teach in 17 languages. But what all teachers can learn are specific strategies. What I talk about is you can't always instruct in the language of the home, but you can always support the language of the home. And there's a huge difference because people will always tell me, I can't do anything in this arena. I don't speak the child's language. I'm not familiar. And it changes. I mean, one of the issues about communities in California is they change. 5 years goes by, and the primary language groups might shift from Spanish to Mandarin Chinese, for instance, in California. But whatever. So one of my primary activities in the last 3 years, really, has been to design these specific strategies for classroom teachers and evaluate them and provide professional training on them. It's still, I mean, and these are, in my paper, I identify what some of those are, and they require enlisting people who are native speakers, and it requires more around family and community engagement, but it primarily requires an attitude shift on the part of the adults and the teachers. If you believe in this, you can do it. And you can do it on Monday morning. No, I have no doubt about that. So my fifth area is teacher qualifications and family engagement. So obviously we need to hire more bilingual, bicultural teachers and staff. But again, sometimes people say to me, well, what we need to do is just hire more people from the community who speak those languages. Maybe, maybe not. I mean, just because you speak the language of the children and the families does not mean you're qualified to teach them. And these children have a very limited amount of time in these educationally oriented programs. So we have a real obligation to provide the highest quality education possible. So you would never hire a teacher just because they spoke English. You know, so I think we have to go a little bit beyond. Yes, we want all of our staff and all of our faculty, everybody who's worked, is to the extent possible, including ancillary staff, to represent the cultures and the languages of the children. And that's a whole topic in of itself that requires lots of layers of investment and resources, starting with higher ed, but not just higher ed. Okay. So my and then in terms of family outreach, I'm going to talk about that a little bit in my recommendations, but I had several recommendations. One of the things that I would look to, and I think it's very consistent with what we've been saying today, is that our outreach strategies have to get more sophisticated and more targeted. You have to know who the children and the families are in your community. If they are accessing the available services already, and what their languages and cultures might tell you about them. You would be surprised how many communities I go into and they say, this child's not making any progress, and they'll go on and on and on about the difficulties. And I will ask them, tell me about the child's home life. They don't know. They don't even know what language the child's speaking in the home. This is an easy fix. It really, truly is an easy fix. We developed a family languages survey, but we're not the only ones. Other people have these kinds of things that give providers access, a window into what has happened in the home with the child from birth in terms of language exposure and the family's preferences and aspirations for the child. It starts with, if you want to know this information, we can find it out. But you have to believe it's important, and you have to believe it's important to know about the children and the families. So targeted outreach strategies. And then the focus on quality improvement efforts, and we have QRIS, quality rating improvements, if you're in the early childhood field. These are really emerging as strong influences on the quality of on the level of quality across different early childhood contexts, so from home care to not so much relative care, but center-based care, and the Race to the Top Early Learning Challenge grants. That's what that was all focused on, was really working across sectors to improve the average experiences that young children from language minority and low-income families experience. So that's another, I think, area that I think I mentioned, and it's in my paper, that what we're finding is that those providers, child care providers, that are working in child care homes and relative care more consistently provide bilingual language support for children. And I think that's probably why they're chosen. But so they're more culturally consistent with the families, and they will provide home language support in the actual child care experience. Preschool children who attend center-based care, dual-language preschool children who attend preschool care in this country, it's like 90% of them receive no support in their home language. It's huge. I mean, in California, which is hugely diverse, it's even higher than that. I think it's like 93% or something like that. So in general, center-based care is doing an English immersion model, which we actually... I'm editorializing a little bit here, but an English immersion model for children who don't comprehend English when they come into that model, in my opinion, really puts these children at a disadvantage because it doesn't capitalize on the linguistic resources that they have as they bring into it. All right, I'm almost done. My third recommendation has to do with really clear specifications about what constitutes high quality in early childhood for dual language learners. We really don't have that with the guidance, and several of us are kind of working on it, but to have some national overview, perspective on this, I think would really help push the field forward on it. People are confused. They are really confused about what to do. And I'm not going to talk about assessment, because if you can't assess a child's capabilities, then how the heck can you design appropriate intervention for a child or appropriate education? There's a lot of work going on in this area, but we're just beginning to really have the instrumentation and the recommendations that will help states and local people capture capacities and understand those to design appropriate programs. And family engagement, again, I mean, one of the very simple things that we did in Los Angeles Unified School Districts was design this family interview that all providers sat down with families. And it's not, you don't send it out and have them check it off. You sit down, and if you need to, you have an interpreter with you, but you find out from the families a lot of really important information. And if we start there and make it more compatible with familiarity, cultural preferences, et cetera, I think we will see, it's an untapped resource. Just like the children's linguistic capacity is an untapped resource, the potential of linguistically diverse families to contribute to school functioning, we've barely scratched the surface on that. And so I think, you know, I would agree with whoever said this is an important moment. And if immigration reform is really truly going to happen this year, then I think these educational supports can be embedded within that, and hopefully we can come at some of these integrated, cross-sectional, cross-discipline, common, because our issues are very, very similar in health and education. So thank you. That's it.
I think that that one would hope that could happen, but I think the strategy too often whenever we're looking at immigration bills is to throw out anything that might be thought to cost a penny or two or more because it'll weigh down the bill. So that's a good part of the reason for this session is to really be connecting up the need for different investments and see what of those pieces might move through immigration reform bills or through other measures this year. So tons of policy issues to follow up on here. We can take a few questions and then at a time might be a better way to use the time that we have for Q&A. Folks want to just raise their hands, we'll come around with the microphone and please say your name and organization. Joy, model good behavior here, please, for the taping purposes.
Joy Payton, Center for Applied Linguistics and Alliance for the Advancement of Heritage Languages. Thank you so much, Linda. That was very powerful. I just have two more thoughts I'd just like to add and see what you think. One is that there are language programs in the community that are in place, like, for example, formerly named Escuela Bolivia. What's the name now? Edufuturo. But set up by Bolivian parents in Arlington, Virginia. They have so many things in place with curricula and books and programs for children, parent involvement, teachers. One thing that schools can do is find out what community-based programs are around here and how can we collaborate, because very powerful collaborations can happen. Another.
Can you mention the name again?
Edufuturo. Yeah, we can give you the information. It's in Arlington, Virginia. It used to be Escuela Bolivia, and it was founded by Bolivian parents. The other thing is I was just reading about an elementary school in Oregon, which is K through 5, that set up enrichment programs, which all kinds of activity programs, and one of them is a language enrichment program. It's one of the activities in the school. And it turned out that more kids signed up for the language enrichment program than any other program. And what they did in there was to get together and focus on the language of the children, and the children who spoke those languages from home were the leaders. So they called themselves, those kids called themselves superstars. I feel like a superstar because they got to be the leaders and the teachers, and then community people came in just to make sure that everything was okay. So it's bringing in the community students as leaders.
Thank you, Joy. Are there any questions?
I'm Esmeralda from USCRI. My question is, I'm from California, and I was somebody who was I was in bilingual education, meaning that I didn't even learn English until I was about third grade. However, it strikes me that, yes, we do need more teachers that are qualified, that speak the languages, but it seems to me that even in California, where there is so much diversity, that there's kind of a lack of people who are qualified, who could teach, that speak the language. Do you think that that's something that's true? And also, the second question that I have is, what do you think about, like, the schools that have, for example, San Francisco has a lot of the schools where they teach you in a different language than English. So.
Right. Okay, let's hold on to that question, and then Michael had another question up here. Lisa? And let me say, Esmeralda, USCRI, that's U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants. Okay, so USCIR, for folks who don't know the organization, is one of the seven or so major resettlement agencies for refugees that funnels folks at the national level to local sites for resettlement. So, and they're the international institutes around the country are their affiliates for refugee resettlement.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here. Michael?
Just a point of information for those of us who don't work all the time in education, to expand a little bit perhaps on the early learning challenge grants and the opportunities that it presents for introducing some of the reforms that you and practices that you discussed earlier.
Okay. So if folks could just raise their hands so Lisa knows where to go next, but we'll take, there's a question all the way in the back, Lisa, but just a sec while we answer these questions. And then if I might say to Rob, please jump in also on what you see happening if any of these issues wind up having a lot of good practices sort of bubble up to the top through the Early Learning Challenge Grant. Where do you think we should look, you know, for what we might be able to learn related to immigrant and DLL best practice there? And then we wanted to make sure, too, that we get to some of the parent issues, because in the absence of immigration reform, there's still a lot of money on the table in a lot of different funding streams to do more with parent education. It seems like not much of it is really lined up with doing good work with immigrant parents. So let's make sure we get that in as part of the conversation, too. But why don't you both say a little bit first about the question?
Sure. Do you want me to go backwards then? The Race to the Top Early Learning Challenge Grant. So they are a subset of Race to the Top. That was a separate grant application. The State Department's submitted proposals to the federal government to do this coordinated system of early care and education. Those of you who work in early childhood know how fragmented it is. You have home child providers, you have family, you have independent community-based organizations, you have pre-K, sometimes Title I programs, you have separate educational, private educational centers, et cetera. And all of these often operate under different regulations, different funding streams, different expectations, and they serve usually different populations. And so with this federal attempt, and actually Jacqueline Jones, one of our colleagues, was instrumental in designing it as a federal attempt to address the needs of children, the children that we're talking about today, the children who typically enter kindergarten already, you know, a year to a year and a half behind on the kindergarten entry assessment. So anyway, states applied. And did any of you apply? Did any of you, if any of you read or reviewed it? These were, I mean, I've written federal grants before. These were so monstrous. They had to literally know in their application where every child of color who doesn't speak English lives, where every low income. So they had to describe where the populations are. They had to describe what services these children are currently getting, and then what their plans are around assessment, around improved educational practices, around coordination. And I think one of the huge issues is coordinating across sectors, because that's kept us in this kind of piecemeal approach to educational improvement in the country. So I think it has tremendous potential. States are just beginning to implement it. Originally there were 9, and I think they just funded another 7 or 8 or 9. So it's a small number of states at this point, but I think 37 originally applied. So at least 37 states have these applications. If you work in a state, I would definitely find out if they have submitted an application for Early Learning Challenge Grant, and I would get a copy of that, because it has great data in it. One of the issues that I think our group today needs to consider, they are required to develop kindergarten entry assessments. And what I have seen to date is that most of those are English only. And there are no provisions for dual. There are some exceptions, like the state of California, which got a grant, already has provisions for assessing dual language learners. But most states are adopting, because psychometrically it's so much easier. And it's a huge challenge to develop a test that would be as valid for children who don't comprehend English, clearly. So I think that's on the horizon for states. But it also is a tremendous potential thing, you know, to go back and find out about in your states. The other issue about, do we have staff that speak lots of different languages that are qualified, even though California has lots and lots of languages? And I think that whole issue of qualifications, because that's the argument for keeping qualifications low, is that when you have child care providers and teachers, if you're looking for diversity and you require teacher certification, that you limit the pool. And there are arguments on both sides of that issue. So in terms of qualifications, Yes, the numbers are aren't what they need to be, even in terms of Spanish speaking. But even in situations where they are proficient in Spanish and bilingually certified, sometimes they don't even, they're not given permission to use those skills in their educational classroom. So it's a little bit of a mixed bag. And teaching in other languages, yes. You know, I mean, that's the other argument that we make, that if you're an English-only child and you're doing real, and I actually think we're coming to this in this country, is that families who are doing a great job, you know, middle-class professional level kind of families, are starting to understand the benefits of being bilingual for all kids. And so I think once that demand starts steamrolling, we're going to see lots more dual language opportunities for children, you know, the children that we serve typically from recent immigrant low-income families. So,
great.
I was gonna, you know, I've been doing all these observations for the foundation and in Texas and in the public preschool and elementary schools that they feed into, and they almost just, the population is just so heavily immigrant that, you know, the vast majority of the classrooms are technically bilingual or dual language classrooms. And so one of the things we went in to do these standardized observations of instructional quality, we also at the same time, for classes that were bilingual or dual language, there's actually about 12 different designations that we also did a protocol to do quality of sheltered English or sheltered instruction. So it's really teaching kids content in their home language while also teaching them English at the same time so that they don't fall behind in content and skills while they're also picking up English. And we couldn't do it. I mean, there's just no... In these classrooms, there was no English. So they were officially, you know, if you look at the district reports, they were officially designated this way, and they were monolingual in practice. And it was, I mean, 70 classrooms. I mean, that's and randomly sample. I mean, that's data about, and I don't know to the extent that that is true everywhere, and it became less, it was less true as you got out of the preschool programs and moved more into the elementary school, especially as you got closer to third grade, but it's still there. Now, several of these schools also were officially dual language programs where even monolingual English kids would be taught in Spanish, and which I always think is funny doing this because, as Linda was saying, my my niece and nephew in Dallas, my brother is much more fancy than I am, so he can afford to send his kids to the fanciest possible school where they are taught in two languages, because that is something that, you know, well-educated people think is a great thing to give to your kids. So what this is doing is democratizing that idea, but what it creates this weird mixture in these classrooms, in these schools, because it's mostly, you know, lower SES. In Texas, it's mostly low SES Spanish speaker children, and middle class white children whose parents want this for them. So they're generally more progressive, but for some reason they either do not have the means or to send their kids to one of these private schools that has this, or they are committed to public education. So it's a combustible group to manage. And my impression is that the white middle class parents who have kids in these programs are more likely to become dissatisfied over time with the program as their kids get older. And they're more likely to drop out of these programs than the other group. So these are weird balancings, and I think that this is one good reason to have developmental scientists and people from the social sciences within the field of education, because while we might not be thinking about actual the details of pedagogy, we know a lot about these what I would call more human conflicts that happen in those situations. About the parent engagement and parent investment, I mean, I think it's a huge part, and I'm certainly convinced that the best way to get around these many of these issues outside of the classroom itself that children are in really is investing in the parent generation at the same time that you're doing early intervention for young kids. And that while that is true of many disadvantaged populations in the United States, I think it's especially true for immigrant parents, especially immigrants from Latin America, because there's such a range of factors working into, you know, the problems that might be going on between families and schools. And it really, you know, investing in the human capital of immigrant parents is one way. It does come with some risk, but it is one way to empower parents in the school and to familiarize them with the school and to allow them to be advocates in school. There's also what a psychologist calls the synchronicity issue, which is that parents that are doing educational activities at the same time that their kids are, that there's something about doing that together that engages both of them at the same time. The problem, of course, is that many of the big demonstration programs that we've had about investing in parents' education haven't worked so well. But I really do think that that's more a judgment on the programs themselves and the narrow scope, and that we need to think more fully about that issue. So I think that this is something definitely moving forward. To me, that's really where we need to go.
And it looks like it's one of those areas that at the district and the state level, mm-hmm. that for advocates in those positions, it's not like you're asking for something new. It's a reshape of something that everybody
yes.
already wants to do. So I think we have time for one more question. We can do two. I guess it's hard if you're back to back there.
Hello, good morning. My name is Ezzy, and I'm from World Ebony Network. Our organization's mission is to strengthen the people of African ancestry. I was born here in Alabama, lived in Bozeman, then went back to Nigeria. And when I got there, I struggled to learn the Nigerian language so I can fit in there. Mm-hmm. It was very hard. I had to change accents and all that. Then came back here at the age of 21, 22, and even though I lived in an environment in Nigeria that was in the university environment that pretty much had everything here, but there were still areas that I ended up having to try to fit into here. But then I came in already married and then started making babies and raising them, and I now have teenagers. One of them is with me here. I did want to, for them, what was done to, for me, which was teaching me speaking the language. My dad said you had to speak it, and so I did. And I come here and in the 21st century try to teach my children the same thing that was done for me, the values and everything. Somewhere along the line, there's conflict, the cultural conflict, especially because of the ethnic origin that I come from. They have so many dialects. And what I'm teaching, what they're speaking is not what a lot of the other communities speak, but they somewhat understand them. But in Nigeria, there are 200 and something languages. And then in school, when they talk about teaching African language, Swahili is the only thing that they teach. So in starting the organization, I had tried to find out, you know, how could my children continue to learn their language and at school, you know, find out that they do it in school without having to feel some kind of conflict. And they said, well, it's a little bit hard, but if you can get your communities to support what you're doing and beg for that, then that could happen. So my question to you is, what would you suggest or recommend to the black immigrant community in trying to help manage this language issue? Because that's really very, very important. Our children, at some point, they don't want to speak it, even though you've taught them, but at some point they're ashamed to speak it. My children speak the language very well, but at this point now I'm kind of a little disappointed because they're expecting me to speak English in front of their friends rather than their language. So I was just wondering, what would you recommend?
We're going to do just the other question and then take that one. Go ahead.
Hello. My name is Batilda, and I am the founder of Chances, a collaboration for health advancement, networking, communities for economic sustainability. I was listening to what Mrs. Espinoza was saying about the language, the importance of language in early years. And I just wanted to add that sometimes we have to consider religious practices For example, if you look at some West African countries or Pakistan, most of those countries are Muslim countries. And usually the practice is when you have a child, before the child reaches 4 years old, they have to know the Quran. So what they usually do is they take those kids to those, sometimes it's a center-based child care, and usually the child is taught to memorize the Quran, which is in Arabic. They don't really learn the English language. So by the time they get into school, they already have a delay, and it's difficult for them to adapt. So I was wondering, do you sometimes, in your research, reach out to embassies and community radios or community organizations so that you can raise awareness on the importance of learning English in order to help the child develop well? Thank you.
Okay. In direct response to your question about whether or not we reach out to embassies, we haven't, but that's a great idea. What we usually look at within communities are what are the community organizations that can continue to promote the home language, and those frequently they're churches. You know, places where families go where they feel comfortable and supported in speaking their home language, then we really try to work with them to get them connected with the schools, the early care and education programs. But the embassy thing, you know, I don't work in the capital, so I don't have a lot of contact with that. But it kind of relates to that earlier question, too, and I'll take a stab at this, and then maybe, Bob, mm-hmm. you can. In terms of how do you communicate to families, particularly when it's a minority family. I have very close friends, for instance, that were immigrants from Bosnia during that war, and they had such negative feelings about their native language that they refused to speak it in their home, even though they were so heavily accented, it was hard for me to understand them. So they were speaking only English. They didn't believe in the value of their home language because they had deliberately taken their children out of a war-torn area and felt like that was not going to benefit them in their school readiness. Okay, a couple of things about that. Your statement about they're losing their home language, what we're finding in studies in California and Florida is that, in fact, three-year-olds are starting to prefer to only speak English because they go into these settings where they're surrounded by English-speaking peers. English is the language of instruction, so they pick up this message very quickly that that's the cool language. That's how I communicate with my friends and get everything I want. So they go home and they stop. In some cases, people have told us, my child won't speak back to me when I speak to my child in Hmong or Greek or whatever. Okay, so we actually, there are several publications that deal with this, but the main thing that we have to help parents understand is two is more than one plus one. Two is better than one. Do you want your child to be potentially gifted? Do you want your child, you know, to excel linguistically? Then you really need to keep two. The first language does not in any way impede English acquisition. And matter of fact, it facilitates it. I think these are common misperceptions about young children in language learning. And families, you know, all the families that I've worked with, the first thing they say is, we want our child to learn English. You know, and it's your job. It's your job to teach my child English. And they want to support us, and they think the way to support us is by shifting into English in the home. I think that's one consistent message that we can send out, and it's related to family engagement, is that family's part of your role, and they're very eager, you know, eager to assist us with this school success goals that are so important. Your role is to continue to use the home language so they don't lose it. Because if they lose it, what we've found over and over again is that you're going to have problems later on, you know, in adolescence and whatnot, that you know, there are negative consequences to learning your home language. There are multiple benefits to acquiring two languages. And in some situations, in some communities, the only way a child can maintain their home language because the schools are not prepared is when the family continues certain practices. They are really, really, sorry.
Yeah, okay.
They are really important in this goal. Because I don't see schools doing this overnight.
Right. And we had been talking earlier, I think, I don't know if it was up here or at the tables, about that one of the, since we're not going to be able to have dual language instruction, since all teachers can, you know, that there really is a whole piece there for schools to do more with parents about what they can do to support home language development. So we'll have more time to talk about some of these things in the policy kind of takeaways at the end. Rob, did you want to make any closing comments?
I was just going to say, it's a takeaway from all of this is that, you know, it is true that there's increasing demand for these types of services and instructional strategies across a wide variety of languages, and I don't think that the system is capable of accommodating that diversity, and it's just totally impractical. But what the system can do is help devise strategies to help parents from many diverse groups that to get this sort of support in their community. I mean, so it's, even if the school isn't providing it, what the school can provide, even if the school isn't providing those services themselves, what they can do is do a better job of helping connect families in their school to those services outside of the school.
For more information on the Migration Policy Institute's Young Children of Immigrants Conference, visit www.migrationpolicy.org/integration.